Bienvenidos a un nuevo episodio del podcast de K-Fan, un espacio en el que aprender de emprendedores que han creado, escalado y a veces vendido empresas tecnológicas.
El episodio de esta semana lo patrocina Factorial, el software de recursos humanos que hace el trabajo pesado por ti. Comienza a gestionar tu empresa con reportes avanzados, nóminas, un gestor de vacaciones, control horario y mucho más. Factorial, la asesoría laboral del siglo XXI. Descubre más en factorialhr.es.
Good morning, everyone. I'm here with Lina Chan of Target Global. How are you, Lina?
Very good. How are you, Jaime?
I'm good. We're all confined. Well, you're not actually confined. I am, but not you. You're the lucky one.
We didn't. Some of us decided Corona was just over for us.
Yeah, exactly. So for those who don't know you, I wanted to have you on the show or on the podcast because basically, and we'll talk about this later on, in recent years or even recent months, a bunch of, we see more and more international VCs like spending time in Spain, making deals, and you're probably your target and you particularly are probably one of the most active ones. And you've opened an office in Barcelona, you just launched a super seed initiative, which we'll talk about. So I was really looking forward to this. But before getting into all those details, tell us a bit about your personal history. Where did you grow up? Where do you go to school? What do you study? What do you do after school? Those kind of things.
Yeah, so I'm from California. I was born and raised for most of my young adult life in Los Angeles. I studied philosophy in undergrad, and then I was on a path to go to law school. And then it was actually 2008 when all of that was going down. And today we know kind of the story with a lot of multinational law firms. They kind of shut their doors, and the world was looking incredibly uncertain, and job prospects were rapidly dwindling to the point where, you know, I thought, okay, it's actually, I really have nothing to lose, right? I'm like super young. I just graduated uni. I think I have a good head on my shoulders, although I kind of graduated with a fairly like non-standard degree. So I went to San Francisco, and for a while there, I was actually just like crashing with friends and my sister who was going to UC Berkeley at the time. And I eventually started my first kind of work in tech through an angel investor. So he was an engineer at Google, and you know, made some money there, and was kind of pursuing his own projects and angel investing. So I got like, you know, exposure into many, many different topics around early stage company building, early stage even investing through him. I essentially then decided that, the U.S. probably, I mean, San Francisco even at that time was pretty saturated with all sorts of, you know, great talent and capital and everything. I thought it would be an amazing time to kind of go and see what else is out there. And I remember someone had recommended actually a few MBA programs out in Europe. I moved to Europe like literally the next year. So in July 2009, I moved to Germany. I enrolled in a kind of a law and business master's dual one-year program, and then ended up joining an angel investor that came out of my business school, BHU, out in Germany, and moved to Berlin. And from there, like, you know, I didn't expect to stay in Berlin or stay in tech, but kind of my big adventures in tech really started there. Like I since founded two companies, one in Southeast Asia, another one out in New York. Worked for a fund / family office here next to Berlin, Hasselplatner Ventures, chairman of SAP, one of the SAP co-founders. I joined a company called ResearchGate doing product and growth and, you know, different topics on monetization. And then rejoined some of the general partners that I worked with at Hasselplatner here at Target Global. And I've been here for 2 years. So that's me in like a couple minutes.
So basically you joined the tech industry as an outsider, right? So because you had guessing no coding skills, no engineering background, nothing like that.
Yeah, not even finance. So no economics, nothing like that. Yeah.
And do you think that's helped you, or has that like slowed you down at any point, or you don't think so?
No, I don't think so. I think in San Francisco, obviously, it gives you a huge leg up if you've graduated from Stanford with an engineering degree. Like, that's no question. But I think in general, you know, there's kind of something for everyone. And I think more than anything, instead of kind of waiting for the world to give you something, what I really enjoyed about my time in San Francisco, what I kind of my biggest takeaways from that time in my life was that you're very much in control and that you very much can create your own opportunities. So I mean, for me particularly, I didn't find, it was challenging for everyone in 2008, 2009, but I didn't find that my background particularly was hindering anything.
Yeah. And continuing on the topic of background, I mean, do you think the fact that you founded companies and you had operating experience has helped you as an investor? Because there's always like this debate about whether you need to have operating experience to be a good VC or a good investor.
I don't know if you absolutely need operational experience to be a good venture investor. I think there's a lot of different skill sets that kind of come from just investing, right? So I think the best venture investors out there were just in the business for a long time, right? Mm. So you kind of just like see it over and over and over again, and you kind of understand how the game works, and you form better mental models, you form, you know, a kind of a stronger inner narrative that, you know, helps you arrive at some conclusion much faster and with much more conviction. What I do find, though, is, I mean, my operational experience definitely helped me in a couple of ways. One is kind of relating a little bit more to founders. And, you know, there's one thing just like looking at a business plan and saying, okay, let's like scrutinize the numbers itself. But behind all the numbers, there's an actual story, right? And there's like all sorts of operational kind of challenges. And I would say, like, even if it wasn't one-to-one, like the experiences I had did not necessarily translate into the hardships or difficulties or challenges of businesses that I invested in. I definitely had a broader understanding, and I kind of got a better feel for what kinds of challenges were acceptable and what kinds were not. And also, like, I guess a better feel for how much a founder or team is kind of really thinking through their challenges or assumptions, all sorts of aspects of the business. I think another way it really helped was, of course, I think more than just like, let's say, just straight investor, I think most entrepreneurs do feel comfortable reaching out for advice and things like that to someone who comes from operations or had built a company before. But I wouldn't say it's like a necessary thing to become a really, really good VC.
Yeah, makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. So moving to Target, I mean, what's your focus as a firm? I mean, how long has the firm been operating? What kind of investments do you make? I mean, you're also pan-European. So tell us a bit about Target.
Yeah. So in a nutshell, we are a pan-European technology investment firm. We manage several funds. So, I think our first real activities were in 2012 with a growth fund. And this was a 400 million euro growth fund. We thereafter launched an early stage fund. This is a fund where I'm active in. Early stage, so fund one, we had already invested from. We just closed fund two in February this year that we're actively investing out of now. And then we launched, was it last year or the year before? I forget. Time flies. In a fully verticalized fund focused in mobility. And that's an additional 100 million, and it's kind of an evergreen fund structure. So we manage different funds. We're headquartered in Berlin, but we have offices all over Europe. I started the office down in Barcelona last year. We have offices out in London, in Tel Aviv, and in Moscow. And we effectively cover everything from east to west, north and south Europe, including Israel.
And in terms of sectors and industries, I guess with so many funds and of different sizes, you're basically agnostic in some way, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we're largely sector and stage agnostic. We do have teams that specialize within certain verticals. Mobility, obviously, through the Mobility Fund, but we do have teams that look at, you know, things like fintech and consumer and SaaS and enterprise. But I mean, as a group, we're able to look very broadly. And then in terms of like check size, we can go, I mean, we have done like 200,000 checks. I wouldn't say that's kind of our core from early stage. Our core is usually around like 1 to 5. So let's say average of 2-ish. And then out of growth, we're able to go up to 30 million euros with an average like check being like, let's say between 10 and 15 million.
Yeah. So as I was saying at the beginning, I think one of the interesting things about Target and yourself is the fact that you opened an office in Barcelona very recently. And I mean, we've seen many firms invest in Spain, I mean, mostly Madrid and Barcelona, and mostly Barcelona, I think, over the years. But these were firms that maybe made a deal and then they would come like once a quarter for a board meeting and then just leave and obviously build a network that way. But you're probably, and I'm thinking out loud, I think you're probably the first one to actually open an office and move someone from their team to be full-time in Barcelona and in Spain. How did that happen and why did it happen?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we started in Barcelona mainly because of our very first investment out there, which is TravelPerk. And I would say it happened rather organically. We didn't really have, like, to be really honest, I don't think in the beginning we had a concise plan and a, you know, kind of a pan-European, like, you know, map with like pins on the map, like, okay, we're going to go here. Like, it really wasn't that way. We met Avi, we met the guys at TravelPerk. We were incredibly impressed with TravelPerk and the team out there. And I mean, you know, slowly but surely, we ended up kind of meeting more and more entrepreneurs. I mean, obviously, first out of Barcelona, because that was the immediate network.
Yeah.
And we're just time and time again incredibly impressed with the quality of entrepreneurs, kind of the magnitude of their of the vision and you know, the impact they wanted to make on the world. And we couldn't really say, you know, we couldn't really see any other reason to not look in Spain, right? So the more we looked and the more entrepreneurs we met, we just, I think eventually we decided that, we should rather open an office there. It did remind us of Berlin in the very, very early days. Like, out of like Shmuel, Yaron, and myself, we were investing in Berlin from Hassel Platinum Ventures, I would say like starting 10 years ago almost, where there was very, very little venture activity. There were some, you know, there were some rocket internet companies and there were some, you know, clones of Groupon and, you know, there was Lukasz Gadowski doing some things through Team Europe. But I mean, in general, it was very kind of early scene. And what we see in Barcelona is it's a little bit more developed than that. I would say as well in Madrid. But still, I feel like there's a lot of kind of not enough kind of competitiveness in risk capital. That's one. And two, I feel like there still needs to be a lot more kind of support for companies that are really ambitious and trying to kind of leave their local kind of boundaries of Spain, their customer groups, even of Europe, because there hasn't been too many entrepreneurs who've done it before, right? So when we kind of like all in all looked at the market there, we were like, oh, we consistently see high quality deals and amazing entrepreneurs. We're like, you know, at that point, I think we've invested in TravelPerk, Body, Mediquo, DocPlanner had just acquired Dr. Alia and decided to move their HQ down to Spain. We were just like, okay, we feel like there's really something going on here and mm-hmm. we should rather be early than late.
Yeah. And do you think you could have done the job that you're doing without living in the city, without moving, actually moving to the city? So just like dropping in Barcelona or Madrid once every month or every couple of months? Or do you think it's key to have like people on the ground and just look for early stage deals?
I think, I mean, of course you can do that. My experience living in Barcelona is that you get a, very different. You're like, you're really submerged, you know, you're like really involved in the whole kind of ecosystem. I'm able to go on like, you know, last minute beers or last minute dinner or whatever, like coffees, right? Whatever meetups there are, whatever, I mean, whatever's going on, you can just kind of pick up and participate, which is, I think, I mean, it's hard to measure like, you know, like from a, in a quantitative way, like what kind of impact that has. But what I must say is, I mean, yeah, I feel like you hear about things first, right? You kind of get introduced to a lot more people and it's a lot more casual, and the quality of the relationships you're forming is a little bit more personable, and, you know, you're meeting more regularly. So absolutely. I think one can do this kind of fly in and, you know, shake hands and meet people like once a month or so. But for me, like really being present in the city, also just helped me understand a lot more around culture and, you know, just how things work, who knows whom, right? Like a lot of the kind of maybe peripheral information that you otherwise wouldn't get. I definitely got a lot of that from being present.
Yeah, and you also got to spend the cold Berlin winter in Barcelona, which is also always good.
Yeah, absolutely. I was actually missing that quite a bit the last couple of months.
So, I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense for you guys, especially the timing, because I think, as I said before, I don't think there's any other like international VC firm who took the leap and did it. And I think that something else that also happens that or helps the fact that you're in Barcelona, and for people who are not very familiar with the local scene, is the fact that at least we see this, or I personally see this, and as a firm as well, K-Fund. So Barcelona, there's like two things. So you have the local ones, so you have the Spanish and you have the Catalan people, who a lot of people start companies, but then you also have like this other audience, which is formed by a lot of expats who basically move to the city just because of the weather, and the lifestyle and all that kind of stuff. And usually, at least from our perspective or from my perspective, usually those two sides don't mix with each other a lot, because they build their own communities and all that kind of stuff. And if you look at it, many of the big successes or relative successes out of Barcelona in the past few years, I mean, there's like a lot, for example, like Abby and Troubleberg or from David and Typeform, who are not actual people from Barcelona. They're actually like expats. Yeah. And usually those people bring connections from abroad, from early stage firms. I think no Spanish investor ever invested in Troubleberg, and the same goes for Typeform. So the fact that you're international as a firm and as a person, I think it also helps you those doors and get to those companies faster.
Yeah, that could be true. I think there's definitely like clusters of communities. And I find that to be true in many, many parts of the world. Even my time in Berlin and out in Jakarta, and you know, even to some degree in San Francisco, you do find clusters of people who, you know, think alike, maybe even look alike, speak alike, right? But I do feel that on the other hand, there's a kind of convergence going on. Like at some point, I think there's a kind of hunger and a big willingness to kind of meet and learn and, you know, like work through some of the basic challenges of starting an early stage business. Kind of together, right? And I think one of the big challenges, especially in the early days in Spain and in Barcelona, or it doesn't actually matter where you are in Spain, is really fundraising and you know, kind of understanding what terms and, you know, who are like good investors to approach, right? So all of that kind of knowledge, I think, I find more and more, like let's say clusters of people getting together, and where I maybe, you know, where I don't see it existing before, like me personally, I think it only helps the ecosystem to connect the various clusters. I think it only brings good, right, to broaden people's network and broaden people's world and perspective.
Yeah. So in Spain with so many funds, you're mostly doing like early stage deals, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm out of early stage, but we do have a growth stage, a growth fund, of course, that we can invest out of for in Spain and around Europe.
Yeah, and how many deals you've done so far in Spain? How many portfolio companies?
I mean, altogether, I think right now we have five. I think it's five.
That's four in Barcelona and Kobe in Madrid, right? I think. Yeah. So what are your, I mean, you've mentioned this a bit, Lina, but what are your thoughts, like positive and negatives, about what you've seen in the country in the past year or so that you've been there?
Ooh, I mean, pros and cons from a tech perspective. I mean, I think, so there's many, many pros. If I were to pick my top pros, it's one, I found particularly impressive was the incredible resourcefulness and creativity of quite a few of like Spanish entrepreneurs. So I don't know where it really comes from. I think, you know, Shmuel, one of our general partners, said it like summed it up in a nutshell pretty well. I'm sure it's like hard to like really generalize across the board, but he said, you know, in Tel Aviv, there's really good like deep tech and you know, cybersecurity. In Berlin or in Germany, there's a lot of like really good process oriented startups, right? So anything having to do with like supply chain or, right? I mean, just anything around like process, e-commerce, like warehouse, right? Like where that's an advantage. In London, you of course find like the biggest, like, you know, or the bigger like fintech, right? Insurtech type startups. And I think what's great about Spain, what he said, which I kind of subscribe to, is that like creativity seems to be the real driver for and differentiator for products and companies coming out of that area. Like usability, a lot of consumer, a lot of thought put into kind of, you know, redesigning either business models or the product itself. Really sharp, like mobile products, right? Kind of like the next generation products of things. Across the board, what I see coming out of Spain, and it is indeed like fairly unique, and that's I think for me one of the big positives.
And on the other side, what about the negatives? I think you mentioned a couple already, like funding and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think definitely there tends to be, it's totally understandable just because there's not that much risk capital around. What I mean by that is like, you know, your group of angels or early stage funds, there's not like a ton of growth stage funds that you can then, you know, reach out to. And there's like, it's just like readily available, right? Like there's a kind of like hurdle you'd have to meet, to be of interest to some pan-European or international growth funds. It's not the same, like as if you were in London and you just have like every fund around the corner, right? So I think just like kind of general lack of risk capital, it tends to be a challenge across the board. I think therefore the competitiveness of capital is also
not as high,
for the entrepreneur. And I think, I mean, another way to think about it is the kinds of businesses that then this behavior encourages, right? So what I find often is like, you know, if you were to put it on a matrix, right, there's like kind of high risk, high reward startups, which is like the Ubers and the Airbnbs, right? Like, and then you have like startups that make a lot of sense. Like there's a clear path to revenue. Like, you know, that more or less like this company will make money unless something is like extremely mismanaged or, you know, something like that. But on the flip side, it's that, you know, a lot of those kind of low risk, kind of low outcome businesses, although they can make for amazing businesses, they're not always venture cases, right? So, and I think that's an important distinction to make in general, is there are those companies that are really fit for kind of venture, like backing, venture capital. And then there's like a whole host of other businesses that are great, but and just because it doesn't make sense for venture capital doesn't make them a good business. But the reality is they don't fit for the venture model.
How do you think about that fit for the venture model? I mean, do you think it's a matter of like size of the market, or do you put like other things into that cocktail to come to an answer?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, of course, size of market is one. I think it has a lot to do with your like personal ambition combined with your product. Like, how scalable is it? How difficult is it to build? You know, and this kind of tends to go hand in hand with like, you know, the early years, like valley of death of startup, right? Like if you're spending the first couple of years building something that doesn't really exist out there, it's going to cost money to build it because, you know, you need engineers and stuff. Like this is what I'm talking about, risk capital. And at the end of that valley of death, it's not super clear, how quickly this will be adopted, how much revenue this thing could possibly make, or how long it will take to make like a considerable amount of revenue, right? There's like just a lot of question marks that come at the end of some of the more innovative or kind of more like high risk companies. Whereas I would say like, you know, let's take like an agency model, right? There's a lot of like great businesses out there that take more of an agency model where it's like, you know, fairly low barriers to entry. A lot of the product builds, it takes like technical, like talent to build it. But it's mainly like a sales and marketing game. And, you know, I think you could scale it if you're a Groupon, you could scale it and have like an amazing kind of world domination plan. But in all likelihood, it's that you're going to like, you're probably not going to scale like Groupon did. And, you know, you'll just like be a good, you know, money making business. I don't know if that really makes sense. I feel like it would maybe help to like get ready with some like examples. I just can't really think of, and I don't really want to call out like specific companies here, but I think you might get the gist of it. I think it's a lot about like really how much risk you want to take at least on the model, like so on the business model side or on the product side.
Yeah, I think it's also like highly subjective. I mean, whether the partner or the firm sees this as a like a company fit for venture, and sometimes there might not be like a proper objective answer or data that you can justify a no or a decision for not being ready for venture. And at the end of the day, I mean, I guess that as a founder, you don't need for 10 VCs to compete with one another. I mean, you pretty much need just a handful of VCs or maybe just one VC to trust you and for them to believe in that it's fit for venture. And maybe they're right and maybe the rest are wrong, but I think it's highly subjective and very, very hard to put data on that.
I think something you're pointing to is also like, you know, what's kind of the whole investment? So what's the thesis of the fund, right? There's funds out there that are like classically like, oh, we're a $1 billion fund and we're going to like 100x, you know? Yeah. This is a very different kind of fund than like a, you know, 50, 100 million fund and saying, okay, like if we like 3 to 5x it, that's amazing, right? So yeah. I think as you're saying, it really also depends on kind of like, what kind of fund are you? What are you looking for? What's your thesis?
Yeah, exactly. So you recently launched something, I'm going to call it the Super Seed Initiative for Spain. People who have been following the news or pretty much in the past couple of weeks, I think, might have read about it. But what is it? What is this thing that you guys are launching for Spain?
Yeah, it's an allocation out of our second early stage fund. It's for COVID times. We thought it was very appropriate to have kind of some sort of program that, you know, does a few things. So one takes like so much talent right now, just out in the market, right? Like either you're furloughed, you're fired or your company shut down or whatever it is. And I truly do believe that there are like, you know, real high quality talent, like people, engineers, product, data, whatever, what have you, just kind of out in the world right now in Spain, just like in their flats or, you know, whatever, and just kind of thinking about the next big thing, right? So to take that like awesome kind of resource, right, and help them become productive and help them kind of give them that early push to build out their early product or business idea and start getting like kind of early market validation for it. So the whole idea there so the allocation from our side is 500k. Euros from early stage fund two, and we would top that up with, you know, some, I mean, we just started with a few people in our network that we know and, you know, we kind of interact with on a more or less regular basis, and, you know, we just kind of like put it out there, hey, would you be interested in participating in something like this? And it was actually incredibly well received, so we got quite a few of our own fund, so portfolio company CEOs, like the guys from Body and Travel Perk, and, you know, like even outside of our fund, like, you know, the guys from like Job and Talent and HouseFi and right. So we got fairly good feedback. So we're kind of building out that entrepreneur base to essentially top up the check. It should be first check in, and it should be like, you know, I mean, very, very early days for the product. And the whole idea is to take it on a case-by-case basis. Like, I'm not sure, like, I wish it could be a little bit more structured, but the reality is I think we're going to get a huge range of, you know, kind of circumstances, number of founders, maturity of product, right? So as much as I would like to, like, kind of standardize the whole thing, I think the reality is we're going to take it case by case. And it's going to be like, I mean, from our side, the check sizes will be somewhere around like 30, 50K-ish plus. And then hopefully we can get that up to like 200K, right, from the whole like network that we're bringing in.
And you're going to back companies at the idea phase? Or are you looking for companies with at least an MVP and a team built or put together?
Yeah, I think it can be an idea, especially if the team is the team to build up that idea. I think what we're seeing so far is that at least a lot of people have started building at least something like a landing page or a website where, you know, yeah, the proposition is a bit more clear. But very, very early, essentially. Like, it can be an idea, it can be a landing page, you can have an MVP, and that's exactly the stage that we're keen on.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. So, Lina, to wrap things up, because we're getting closer to 4 p.m., we were talking about this before starting the recording. I mean, probably the past few weeks or the month of March and early April was super busy for you guys to deal with all the portfolio companies, especially for you, that you probably have, like, I don't know, tens of portfolio companies. How do you see the market? And mostly, I mean, what kind of advice were you giving or are you giving your companies to navigate through these times, understanding that there's probably companies who are being benefited by this and others that are probably suffering?
Right. Yeah, I think, for our own portfolio companies, I think the advice kind of varied across the board, depending on the specific challenges and what kind of verticals they're playing in. I think the biggest kind of advice was, at the end of the day, just survive, right? And whatever it takes to survive. And you can get pretty creative about that. And I think also be pretty honest to yourself about that. None of us really know, like, what the next 1-2 years is really going to look like. Not just in terms of, like, the whole health crisis. Obviously, there's an economic fallout that's, like, you know, on the horizon. I think be honest with yourself, be honest with your team. If you need to cut down costs, do it in a good way, right? I think people are really going to remember kind of how you've handled yourself and managed your team and kind of communicated to your customers, to your employees for some time to come. If you need to hibernate, do it. If you feel like you can strategically position yourself to come out of the tail end in the next 4, 6, 8 quarters, becoming, you know, a kind of like come out of it with a stronger position, come up with a plan to do it and you know, speak with your investors about the capital it would require you to do that. Aside from that, like, you know, I think really just try to take it like 1 week at a time or 1 month at a time, right? And just exercise really good practices around communication. I think that's really the key thing.
Yeah. And from a VC perspective, has this affected you much? I mean, because I've been talking to a bunch of mostly European VCs, and the ones that invest very early, they say they're still as active. The ones that are later stage, they tend to say we're going to take things slowly. How do you see this based on the fact that you guys have like a bunch of different funds and later in different stages?
Yeah. I mean, like across the board, I think most, and I think this will of course differ based on, your fund vintage and things like that. Where your portfolio was, you know, kind of heavy on, like if you had all travel companies, obviously it's a little bit more, you know, stressful, I guess, than someone with like all consumer DTC e-commerce type bets. Right. But I think across the board, like early stage seed and A, honestly, like around the like pan-Europe, I don't see a ton of changes there. Definitely some investors are a bit more selective and a bit more careful with how much and how quickly they're deploying capital, understandably. But for the most part, I mean, for us, for example, we just closed a fund two in February, as I mentioned. So for us, it's pretty much business as usual.
It's fresh money. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I think it depends. I think in growth stages, early growth to growth, like you'll definitely, I mean, also the data showing it, right? There's definitely like money going into tech, but likely more on like maybe follow-on rounds or to a smaller set of companies, a bit more opportunistic. Obviously, like the products that kind of go well with the whole COVID times, right? Like collaboration, remote, digital health. Like I think there's some topics that are seeing a little bit more interest. And obviously, if you're a company that was like doing well before COVID and you were growing and, you know, like you pretty much are a solid business and yeah, COVID maybe has a negative impact on the business, but it's more or less clear that it's a temporary impact. I also think in the growth phases, like these companies won't have too much issues fundraising. But it's also hard to say like across Europe. I think it's different in London and in Berlin than it is in Spain.
Yeah.
And it's totally different across like maturity and vertical. So, but from where I'm sitting in early stage, there's not too much that's changed, maybe just like a bit slower in terms of deal closings.
All right.
Yeah.
Lina, this was great. Thanks a lot for coming. Last question. If people want to reach out to you, how can they do so?
Yeah, they can reach out to you.
Okay. I was going to say enough email. Just bombard email Lina with emails.
Yeah. No, I mean, you can also find me on LinkedIn. I think every investor says this. Get introduced. I think that's really the best way. I'm relatively active on LinkedIn and stuff like that. So just reach out to me any way you can. I'm very hesitant to give out my email because, you know, my email's already a mess.
Good. I knew you were not going to do that. So yeah. I just wanted to ask the question. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Lina. Take care and thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Jaime. Talk to
you
soon.
No problem.